First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Florida teachers are told to make their classroom libraries inaccessible to kids or risk felony prosecution. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, new laws and how they're affecting classroom libraries in Florida. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we continue our series profiling local candidates for office as we speak with District 7 candidate Jimmy Peluso. That and more ahead. But first this hour, Florida teachers, including here in Duval County, are being told to remove all unvetted books from their classroom libraries or face felony prosecution. Now, the policy is based on the premise that teachers and librarians might be using books to groom students or indoctrinate them with leftist ideologies. Students are also being told not to bring in any unvetted books from home. Details of the policy were first shared with principals around the state last week. Schools across Florida are now in the process of bringing teachers and staff up to date on these changes. The new policy is sparking outrage on social media, with a number of teachers sharing pictures of their classroom libraries papered over or restricted in some way. Journalist Judd Legum of Popular Information has been writing about this at his accountability journalism site and newsletter, and he's on the line. Hi, Judd. Good morning.
Good morning.
And folks, let us know your thoughts about Florida laws affecting public school classrooms. The latest change is that there can be no more classroom libraries until books are properly vetted. 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. So, Judd, under new Florida law, all books in elementary school libraries must be reviewed by a certified media specialist. Districts are being told to err on the side of caution to determine if a book is developmentally appropriate for student use, and no unvetted libraries can be accessible to kids now without some sort of review. Let's begin by taking us through the details of this new regulation.
Yeah, this is the intersection of a lot of new policies that have been put into place in Florida over the last year, starting in March when there was a bill passed that required all library books and also books used in the curriculum to be selected by what's known as a media specialist, commonly referred to as a librarian, but in Florida, in Florida schools, they're called media specialists. And, you know, that had some implications, but what we're seeing now is the Florida Department of Education issued rules to execute these new laws. And in so doing, they said, yes, library books, you know, that's written there, but also any collection of books in the classroom is considered a library and has to, under this new law, and has to be vetted by the school librarian as well. And so that's where this current controversy really started, is that teachers all across the country, but also in Florida, you know, typically curate a smaller collection of books for their students in their classrooms. These have been historically just put together by teachers, I think, in most Florida schools. There's no budget for this. It's typically donations, or some of the teachers are bringing in books for home. They're trying to provide, you know, engaging materials for their students to read. So all of these books are unvetted, and therefore now, because the Florida Department of Education decided to apply this new policy to them, they're being, you know, and this is being rolled out. I just heard just before I got on the phone from a teacher this morning, this is still being rolled out in different counties and schools. Mm-hmm. But they're being told, you've got to make these books inaccessible, pack them up, put a piece of paper over them until you can vet them. And these are, of course, many thousands and thousands of books. So it's going to be quite a process.
We've seen social media posts of teachers in Florida schools showing their classroom libraries covered up with paper so that the titles are no longer accessible and kids can't look at the books. We have an email from a Duval County Public Schools teacher. She tells the show, "I was told yesterday that all of my books that did not come from the district or a Scholastic classroom book set had to be boxed up and put away. I'm a reading interventionist, and I work with students reading below grade level. I now have zero books for my kids to read during their free time with me. My heart aches. I was running a little free library out of my classroom. It was filled with books that friends and others donated to me. I work in a low socioeconomic neighborhood. I was able to give books to students who don't have access to books outside of school. It has all come crashing down, and my heart hurts so badly. When will all of these so-called freedom initiatives stop?" she says. She's also included in her email to us photographs of her classroom library. She's put crime scene tape across the books, that the yellow tape that says caution. So, Judd, let's explain the rationale behind this new policy. The governor and the legislature are doing this because of concerns that students are being groomed by inappropriate material, they say, in some instances in Florida classrooms. Wasn't that the rationale?
Yeah, and that's how this intersects with a lot of other things that are going on in Florida and more broadly nationally. And I think there's a few different issues, one of which is this idea that's being pushed by a lot of conservative activist groups, that teachers and librarians, for that matter, are pushing what they consider pornographic material onto students. In many cases, these are books that are not pornographic, but have LGBTQ characters and themes, and in some cases, sexual situations. And of course, this has been the role of libraries for some time, is to, in the best cases, make children feel or anyone feel a little less alone, to find some sort of story that might make them feel less isolated. So librarians are not just for LGBTQ students, but for all sorts of different students are looking for books that might connect with them wherever they find themselves in life. So that's where this this idea that all these books must be vetted comes from, is the notion that there's this pornographic or obscene materials. But I think in almost all cases, that's not actually what's happening.
Now, at the same time, you mentioned media specialists must vet the books. John emails the show, how is that going to happen when in Duval County they got rid of all the media specialists as a cost-cutting move? We don't know yet how these books will be vetted, Judd, in districts where the staff isn't there to do this review process.
Yeah, and Duval is not the only county that has that problem. There are many counties in Florida where either the county doesn't have media specialists or not every school has media specialists. And keep in mind, even the ones that schools that do have media specialists, you might be talking about hundreds and thousands of books, across every classroom, because an individual teacher might have collected over the years a couple of hundred books in their classroom. And all of these need to be vetted individually. And the punishment, and this is explicitly in a training that was just produced by the Florida Department of Education, reminds these media specialists that if they make the wrong decision, they could be subject to felony prosecution, a third degree felony, which is the same category as manslaughter in Florida. So it's quite serious. But yes, I think it's unclear what's going to happen in counties like Duval. I think in some cases they are soliciting volunteers, parent volunteers. And then those lists of catalog books will be sent to a media specialist at the district level. But obviously, that's an even slower process where there's one or two people for the entire county who's going to have to be reviewing submissions from volunteers from every school. So there's really no, there's really no practical sense of how long this will take or what the process will entail.
As we talk about this, we want your calls. Our guest this morning, journalist Judd Legume of the accountability newsletter Popular Info. What are your thoughts about this, folks? 549-2937. Kendra in Mandarin. Hi, Kendra.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. I have to say that I've been a teacher for 30 years, primarily early elementary and reading intervention. And Governor DeSantis's push for this censorship is really making our job untenable. We are underfunded, and as the gentleman said, most teachers get their classroom libraries from donations, book sales at the library, garage sales, money that they spend of their own on their own time. When we have children learning to read or even fluent readers, we need them to read with great breadth and width. We need them to read vastly, cross-curricularly, fiction, nonfiction, multiple genres. There are no personnel, no extra personnel, no any personnel in any school or school district who are just sitting around with nothing to do, who have time to vet thousands of books. That will never happen. And this is a great disservice to teachers whose job is now going to be totally untenable, and kids. I understand that maybe there are sensitive subject matters that some people are concerned about. All parents have always had the ability and the authority to let the school know if they don't want their child to engage in any particular lesson or content. But to be told that even kids can't bring in their own self-selected books is just such a disservice to literacy. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Kendra. Judd, this policy is removing any agency for teachers to decide on their own what books they'd like kids to have access to. Florida is, in effect, saying we do not trust teachers to handle this in their own classrooms.
Yeah, and the abuse that your caller just expressed and the frustration that she's expressing is something that I've heard from numerous teachers throughout Florida. And I think it's a situation that is only going to get worse because teachers are still just finding out about this. This hasn't been something that's been communicated broadly yet. Every school district's handling it a little bit of a different way. And yeah, it's a huge new burden, and it's unclear, who has the time to do this task. And in the meantime, there's going to be far fewer reading opportunities and reading material available to students.
Caitlin in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Caitlin. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So my child is going to be starting kindergarten in the 2023-2024 school year. And it's just, I'm looking at there's 6,000 teacher vacancies in Florida. And between that being severely underfunded compared to other states in the country, the Don't Say Gay bill. And now, I mean, it's hard to even say the fact that they're saying make your libraries inaccessible. It's like I'm wondering what the end game is here for Ron DeSantis and our schools, because, I'm looking at it. I want my daughter to have a well-rounded and balanced education. And the only way I can see that happening is homeschooling her and sacrificing an income to do that. But, we know that enrollment and performance has to do with how many of our public schools are open and how they get funding. And it's a difficult choice because we want, school to be accessible to other kids. So I want to enroll my child, but I want her to be educated. And it's like, parents are frustrated, teachers are frustrated, and I can't fathom what Ron DeSantis is thinking is going to happen to our schools.
Caitlin, thanks. This applies to public schools by and large, Judd, and let's explain that private schools are not subject to these changes. And Judd, what about the fact that the governor was reelected by double digits on a platform of these very kinds of policies?
Well, that's true, I think he does have it is his prerogative to put into place whatever policies he wants. I think there are also constitutional protections that apply not just to public libraries, but also mm-hmm. to school libraries. I imagine that some of the policies put into place already being challenged in court, and some of these may be. So it's there are limitations on what he could do on that score. I think one of the things your caller brought up that's important to point out is that this does relate to the Parental Rights in Education Act, also known as the Don't Say Gay bill, because although that bill does not apply to libraries in the text, it says it should only apply to classroom instruction. The training that was produced by the Florida Department of Education does not say that. It does not tell the media specialists that. In fact, it goes the other direction and says there are commonalities between restrictions on what can be part of the curriculum and what are in library books. And one of those commonalities is that you can't have indoctrinating concepts. And the idea of the types of instructions that are prohibited by the Don't Say Gay bill are part of that list. Mm. So they're really trying to encourage media specialists to take a very expansive view of that law. And I think as this is implemented, some media specialists could choose to remove books with LGBTQ characters and themes from school libraries. Some Florida schools are already doing that on an administrative level outside of any challenge or action by the media specialist.
Dylan in Riverside. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, good afternoon. Good morning. I wanted to say, as a moderate Republican, I don't find these policies aligning with the way that I expect my party or any party to responsibly govern. I think this is nihilism and intimidation, and I don't understand what it's for. The books my wife locked away yesterday, many were Caldecott Award winners, were seminal in helping foster.
Oh, your wife's a teacher. Is your wife a teacher? Is your wife a teacher?
She is.
Okay.
She is indeed. And those books our family donated, as my wife's school is in a lower socioeconomic area. So we wanted to make sure that those excellent books were provided to those children. Our most talented teachers are expressing incredible frustration, and I expect them to leave the field. This is a conversation we have almost nightly now. And this is some kind of naked political ploy that sacrifices our economic future, which is the point of education, for short-term political gain. I'm so mad, and I'm embarrassed to be a Republican. Hell, I think today I'll be an NPA. I'm just really, really furious about this. That's my comment.
All right, Dylan, thanks for your call. What about this, Judd? Teachers leaving the field, parents saying that they'll pull their kids out of school. Here's an email from Kate. I'm a former teacher and retired. Why can't we handle books parents might find objectionable the way we handle students whose parents have differing religious beliefs? They don't have a Jewish student, for example, take part in Christmas activities. This should be no different. Another email, this one from a professor of English at UNF. This is censorship, plain and simple. So, Judd, we can certainly expect this law to be challenged, as others in Florida have been, as you said, on First Amendment grounds.
I think that's right. Specifically, the idea that these books are being removed based on, based on their content. There's obviously some narrow exceptions where you are allowed to remove books, but it's not the case that a government can simply decide to remove whatever books it wants from a school library. And I think your last caller, it's just really important to emphasize how much care and resources and energy teachers put into creating these classroom libraries. Totally thankless work. And I think that's why this story has sparked such a strong reaction, is because it's really an affront to these teachers sort of questioning their commitment to their students. Because really that's what these classroom libraries represent, is a deep and enduring commitment to the students and doing everything they can to support, their growth.
Elizabeth in Intercoastal West. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
All right. Thanks for calling.
So I'm Elizabeth Anderson. I just was on the Duval School Board recently. And,
oh, okay.
You know, as I talk with folks across the city still related to this literacy issue, the irony is it's literacy week this week, right? Mm-hmm. And so as these stories are coming out, teachers and principals are devastated that they're facing potentially felony charges to have to look at reviewing every single book, making sure it's cataloged, putting it in a searchable database. Teachers are feeling like you don't trust us to make these decisions about our students and what they can read, even though we're trained in this and we're certified, but you want us to carry weapons in the classroom? It's very confusing. And now we've got this new HB 1 bill that's come out to expand vouchers, which will send our public money to private schools that don't operate under these same restrictions. And when we watch that play out in the long run, we see a necessary hierarchy that develops because there has to be winners and losers in this game. And so parents that have means and ability will send their kids on the voucher to private schools where these regulations don't exist, where accountability doesn't exist, and children that are struggling in underserved and under-resourced communities will be stuck in environments where they don't even have access to full history, to a full education, to robust literacy resources. The state has put this law in place, but there's not even funding to staff the personnel needed to do the review so that books can get back in the hands of children. I'm frustrated because, and I'm sure you can hear it in my voice, because this is fear-mongering and chaos and distraction to continue the privatization movement and to get rid of public schools, which has been such an important part of the American fabric for so long.
That's former school board member Elizabeth Anderson, who just called in. Jed Legume, we should point out, Ms. Anderson was defeated in her race by a far more conservative candidate who's affiliated with Moms for Liberty and now sits on the board and does speak for a fair number of voters out there who approve of these policies. That said, I'd like to get your thoughts about Anderson's comment that this policy change will most negatively affect kids from low-income neighborhoods, BIPOC kids, kids who may not have access to a wide range of reading materials outside of school. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that she's certainly not the only one who interprets all of these actions taken together as a way of, in some respects, demonizing public school teachers, because the suggestion here is that without oversight, without these rules, they would be exposing children to damaging materials, that they don't have the kids' best interests at heart, and that ultimately this will be used as a justification to defund schools and shift more resources into private schools. Now, whether it all plays out that way, it remains to be seen. But, you know, as she noted, there is legislation that that's been introduced that goes down that path. Certainly, DeSantis has the support of the Florida legislature, and everything is on the table.
Here's an email from a teacher. He doesn't want his name used. He says, 2 weeks ago in our weekly briefing, the school district offered us the opportunity to have the public library come to our schools, read a book, and allow kids to check out those books, as well as field trips to the library for the same thing. Talk about irony, he says. Let's take one more call. It's Emmett in Mayport. Emmett, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Thank you, Melissa. Melissa, I was a naval officer, went to Tulane University, English major, philosophy minor, psych minor, anyway. Had a lot of education background, I got out of the Navy as a lieutenant commander, went into Duval County at the beaches and taught school over a number of years, including a gifted class, which was amazing. We brought many, many, many things to the classroom that were not in the library and that were from our own educational background and friends and scientists. One of the things that all of this uproar is doing is bringing to the attention of people through your show, for instance, how important education is. But it's disrupting the teachers. The schools and the school board should monitor the teachers. But as many people, Dylan, for instance, has said, the education is not just about today and one issue and one. It's about the whole program. I believe I grew up in Western Nebraska, great public school system. I believe that public schools are wonderful. They will not be driven out. But locally here, there are a lot of private schools and a lot of them are very weak. But in the end, this whole uproar disrupts the classroom, which it shouldn't be allowed to do. It's good to consider the points. It's good to consider the issues. But there are wonderful teachers with wonderful libraries, with a whole life of knowledge and experience that they bring to the children. They should not be upset. They should be talked to, monitored, and if they're evil, gotten rid of. But teachers and the children interface is something that is, it's just alive and rich, and it does enrich the children in ways that can't even be imagined by the legislature unless they've been in the classroom. And as one final example, I had a class of boys. I took them for 1 year. We call them the Terrible 20. The school went through the worst kids in their classes and put them in my room for 2 hours a day. Well, we had to be very creative and create some things. A lot of them couldn't read. They just had issues. But in the end, the classroom and their interaction with one another and the education.
Yeah, that was part of the experience, sure.
Exactly.
And that was part of their education. Kids. Yeah. Emmett, I hate to cut you off, Emmett, okay. Because I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts over your experience. But I want to thank you because we are coming up against a break. That was Emmett calling in from Mayport, another retired teacher. And so, Jed Legume, as we continue to follow this, your final thoughts?
Well, I think that it's going to be interesting to see if the schools maintain this policy moving forward. I know that there was a meeting in Manatee County last night regarding this policy that got quite heated. I think you've seen from the callers that teachers are quite upset about this, and it'll be interesting to see if DeSantis and his administration stick to their guns.
Jed Legume of Popular Info, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead. Later, a little good news for your Wednesday. But up next.
We're doing well, but we do see some issues with rising costs and availability of materials and labor.
A look at the trends shaping Florida's booming real estate industry. We'll be right back. Well, the Urban Land Institute is out with a new report highlighting trends shaping the real estate industry. It got us wondering what it means for Florida. For more, I spoke with Patrick Krachowski, partner at Balch & Bingham and chair of the North Florida District Council for the Urban Land Institute, and Billy Zeitz, VP of Government Affairs with Corner Lot Development Group. Here's that conversation. Patrick, Billy, good to be with both of you. Patrick, let's start with you. ULI is out with its new report, Emerging Trends in Real Estate. What are those trends here in Jacksonville and Florida?
Well, good morning, Melissa, and thanks for having us. I think the last time I was in your studio a few years ago, was sitting here with the late Dr. Haley talking about a ULI.
From UF Health, yeah.
Yes, talking about a ULI technical assistance panel we did for UF Health, and that project's now underway. So I just wanted to mention that with fond memories and a kind heart. ULI National puts this report out every year in conjunction with PwC. And of course, 2023 is looking to be an interesting year in the market. A lot of hesitation. I heard somebody earlier on the radio this morning call it a slow session, or is it a recession, or is it a correction or a cooling? So everybody was curious as to what the report was going to say, and specific to Jacksonville. We're doing well, but we do see some issues with rising costs and availability of materials and labor, land costs. It's always more expensive now, you hear, to run a business. And so what does that mean for everybody? And really the snapshot takeaway was it's going to be an interesting 6 months. Things will probably start picking up in the third and fourth quarter. But I think a lot of people in the first half of the year are going to be waiting to see what happens and what other people do, and whether we get another couple interest rate hikes and what that does for everybody. So it's kind of a curious period of time.
Okay. Housing affordability is a big concern. Sustainable building. How is Urban Land Institute educating and analyzing those issues?
Yeah, it's a great question, and certainly a topic that comes up often. And, you know, what the report said is some of it's not surprising at all. You know, labor costs are up. Labor availability is tough. Material costs are up. And again, availability is tough. But what we also see is that there are a number of other factors that impact affordability or attainability, whatever phrase you want to use. And that can be as simple as, is this place that you've called affordable or that you want to be affordable, is it affordable to get to work and to get home, to get to school? Is there a grocery store nearby? On the developer side, which Billy here can talk about some more, you know, what's the cost of getting utilities to it and maintaining the property so that it has a long life? You know, not everybody wants a driveway and a yard. So, you know, what are we going to construct and where is it going to be built so that people have a choice of what part of the city they want to live in?
Yeah. So Billy Zeitz, corner lot. What's your perspective as VP at a company that's really been very active and is working on a lot of exciting projects all over the region?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Melissa. And thanks for having us this morning. You know, we're inspired by the challenge, I would say. We've spent a lot of time with our city officials over the past 6 months through their quality of life initiatives to help solve the affordable, attainable workforce housing solutions. It's unique because you have a lot of people aligned that there's a need, and we're really hoping that we can further our partnership with the city mm-hmm. and with people like JEA to help fill that need. Because mm-hmm. having diversity in our type of product, whether it's a for-rent product that's attainable for a family or whether it's a for-sale product that's attainable, that's going to take some fiscal partnership that comes from outside of the private sector. And that's where we're really hoping to take our conversation.
Hmm. And when you talk about build to rent as opposed to build to buy, where's the demand? Where's more of the demand?
You know, that's a good question. The demand is really pretty balanced. I think the build to rent is different than something we've seen here in Northeast Florida. It's prevalent in major metropolitan areas because we've just hit 1 million in our population. It's drawing a lot of attention here. So the build to rent product is an effective way for people to remove some of those barriers for entry of buying a home. Mm. We at Corner Lot are really working hard to find a for sale product that removes some of those barriers to entry. And then also a multifamily product where Melissa and I are neighbors. One of us pays a reduced rent because there's a fiscal partnership with the city, but we don't know that. We have the same exact unit, the same exact model. It's in a great location. It has bus service. So we're really trying to find that balance and that niche for the city of Jacksonville.
And so, Patrick, for people who don't follow your organization, how do you see ULI, the Urban Land Institute, continuing to just be a thought leader in this vital issue of growth and development in North Florida? Because we are seeing quite a bit of it.
Sure. So, you know, on a larger scale, excuse me, ULI is a global organization, over 50,000 members. Here in North Florida, you know, we stretch down to Gainesville, all the way to the Panhandle with about 600 members. And one of the things that I love about what we do with ULI North Florida is our technical assistance program, where we go into an area, whether it's a solicitation by a local government or a property owner, like I mentioned earlier, someone mm-hmm. or an entity like UF Health, JU Arlington, Nassau County, and we analyze for them. We bring in experts countrywide to come in and look at, you know, these areas. We've got 4 scheduled to take place in the year 2023. With the city of Orange Park and some things that are going on there. And so really our goal is to conduct research and to educate. Affordable housing is a huge pillar of ULI's national mission. And so our objective is to let people in this community know what resources we have a global reach of resources, a national reach of resources, or a local reach to help folks understand these problems, understand where the solutions may be, whether that's funding or advocacy or simply education, and then bringing real recommendations that we've seen work in other communities and applying them to the unique circumstances here.
Well, thank you both, guys. Patrick Krachowski, partner at Balch and Bingham, chair of the North Florida District Council for the Urban Land Institute, and Billy Zeitz, VP of Government Affairs at Corner Lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
Well, newly drawn political districts in the city are offering opportunities for new faces. For example, District 7, which encompasses Springfield and parts of northern Jacksonville. Well under the new lines, it now extends from Springfield to Ortega and includes most of the urban core. The current District 7 councilman, Reggie Gaffney Jr., resides in the new District 8. That means District 7 is wide open and plenty of candidates are jumping in. One of them is Democrat Jimmy Peluso. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be on right now. I've been listening to your show for many years.
Well, it's good to have you.
It's great to be on.
You're a manager at Vistar Credit Union. You've run for office before.
Mm-hmm.
What are your priorities for city council if you get elected?
Well, so my campaign has kind of listed them down into three major issues that I care about: neighborhoods, infrastructure, and parks. And there's like caveats to all three of them.
Neighborhoods. Let's start with neighborhoods.
So
what could the city be doing to better improve them?
Well, one of the cool things about District 7 is it goes from Ortega to Riverside, Avondale, Murray Hill, Mixontown, Newtown, Springfield, College Park, EWU, Eastside, and our downtown. So like these are the old neighborhoods that made up the city of Jacksonville prior to consolidation. So in many ways, some of these neighborhoods have not been given the time and attention they deserve. I question if we've had the right political leadership to help guide them in the way that we should. I think they've been ignored time and time again. And these are areas where gentrification could be a major issue, where affordable housing could be a major issue, attainable housing. These are areas that in some cases have very poor infrastructure. So, you know, we want to build a city that's going to be walkable and bikeable. And in some areas, we don't even have sidewalks. We don't have curbs. You know, these are the things that we need to make sure we're putting into all of our neighborhoods, not just the ones in District 7. But, you know, if we want to build a better city, we need to go neighborhood by neighborhood and do it.
And how do we pay for that?
Well, we pay for that through general fund as well as CIP budget. You know, when I go into my infrastructure piece, CIP funds are vital. Our budget for CIP has gone up pretty considerably in the past couple of years, and that's a good thing. That's really kind of the budget that looks at our long-term planning, but we need to make sure that it's going to the neighborhoods that I feel have been neglected the most. There are some areas that don't have light fixtures, and there are some areas that, again, don't have curbs or sidewalks, and that's where we need to put the attention.
So neighborhoods and infrastructure, what else?
So parks is the other big one. And so Jacksonville has the largest park network by acreage in the country. For those that didn't know that,
yeah, the biggest urban park system in America.
Yes, it's super cool. And yet, in many cases, I feel like our parks are lacking. Again, when it comes to funding and when it comes to the individuals who actually have to go and maintain the parks, I question if we have enough staff. I question if we're putting the right money into it. You know, we know that, you know, crime can be an issue in our city. There's no better crime prevention method than for our children to have an after-school activity like going into a park that's clean. It promotes healthy living. We should also have better programming for our parks. I mean, it's something that we are completely lacking. And when you look at some of our peer cities, not just throughout the country, but just in Florida, they've really doubled down on our parks, on their parks. And I mean, St. Pete, no one can question where their priorities lie. I mean, they've created such a beautiful urban park network that extends out to the pier, and we should be doing the exact same thing. It's a shame that in our city, we need to have Riverside Parks now exist. That should be our political leaders making those decisions, pushing for that. And instead, we have to have a nonprofit.
Riverfront Parks Now, you
yes,
mean?
Yes.
Yeah, the coalition of groups
yep.
advocating for all of these things. Here's a tweet from Mandy. How will Jimmy Peluso at Jimmy for Jax, that's your Twitter handle,
yep,
utilize his experience serving in the Navy to inform his leadership on city council? You received a number of awards and commemorations during your Navy service.
Yep. Thank you for saying that. So I served on active duty for about 6 years and then another year and a half of active duty during my time as a reservist. I'm currently now still a reservist and I drill over at NAS Jacksonville, which used to be in the district and now is right outside. But because of my time in the Navy, you really understand how to work with all sorts of different people, different political backgrounds, different ethnicities and classes. You know, you really get a good sense of how to be a proper leader. And that's something that I really want to make sure that I'm bringing to city council. We also learn how to work with the bureaucracy of government, because at the end of the day, Department of the Navy is a very large bureaucracy. Mm. And, you know, that's one of the things that I really want to get in there and make sure that I'm properly, I know how to navigate in it.
Now, there are a number of Democrats and Republicans and a no party affiliated candidate in this race. We will continue to profile different candidates leading up to the March elections. You're a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
This district under the federal lawsuit has become friendlier to Democrats, but still, we are a fairly evenly split city. There's a Republican supermajority on the city council. Mm-hmm. That's not likely to change. What's your message as you go around the district trying to convince more conservative voters to support you?
Well, I'm going to try to put this in a different way. I mean, I think that going to all voters is important, but I also think that we shouldn't abandon the values of the Democratic Party and what being a liberal and a progressive is all about. I mean, we have a lot of voters in this city that couldn't agree more about what happened at JEA, that it was a bad thing. You know, that's liberal.
The attempt to sell it.
Correct. That's liberal and conservative alike. When it comes to parks, when it comes to infrastructure, I mean, we've seen several tax increases voted in by the populace. These are, you know, we saw at the state level minimum wage increase going up. You know, that's conservatives and liberals alike coming together. As I run in District 7, I'm not going to shy away from the fact that I am a Democrat. I think that our city has had sort of this, it's far too conservative in a lot of ways. And I feel like we have too many Democrats that are afraid to show that they have these liberal values, that we have values that really are very popular. We need to make sure that we are announcing ourselves, that we are supporting each other, and that we are building a strong Democratic Party within our city. Now, all that to say, if you're a conservative voter, you should look at my record. You should look at the things that I've done. You should look at the boards and commissions that I'm a part of. And hopefully that alone will convince you, all right, this is somebody that, yeah, sure, maybe his political allegiance is different than mine, but he knows how to get things done.
Jimmy Peluso, candidate in City Council District 7. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you. This was great.
And up next, a little good news for the middle of your week in our What's Good Wednesdays. We'll be right back.
You heard light and graceful repertoire in the last program of the Concert Organ series. Now hear the king of instruments, the Bryan Concert Organ, as it unites with the colossal sounds of brass and percussion for an exhilarating performance on February 11th. Dynamic organist Greg Zelek returns to showcase his mastery that highlights the organ's versatility, musical power, and equally monumental melodies. For tickets, visit jacksymphony.org.
China's population is shrinking, Europe is getting older, and other parts of the world are facing a youth bubble. Could migration help address these problems?
Something on the order of 1 billion people said they'd be happy to move and work in another country.
I'm Ari Shapiro. More on the potential of global migration on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
Next time on The World, protests in Peru began a month ago and have not stopped. They were triggered after President Pedro Castillo was tossed from office. People of indigenous descent were his biggest supporters. They're still gathering in the nation's capital. We ask what they want and why the removal of the former president continues to drive indigenous protests. Our story from Peru on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The U.S. Embassy in Cuba is back open, but mystery still surrounds those suffering from what's been called Havana Syndrome.
I think this is an act of war on our personnel, and we have to figure out who did this.
Roughly 200 diplomats and security forces have been affected by this mysterious ailment, but what exactly is it? We'll meet those behind a new investigation in their hunt for the truth next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jurassic World Live Tour, a family entertainment experience that brings the wonder and thrills of Jurassic World to life, is coming to ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena starting January 27th, running through the weekend. Performer and dino-teer, as he's called, Charles Clark, is on the line now. Hey, Charles. Oh, there we are. Hey, Charles, didn't press the button. How you doing, Charles?
Oh. I'm great. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for bringing me on.
Okay, so tell us about Jurassic World Live. This sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's quite a show. It's a family fun show that's full of dinosaurs and full of exciting stunts and a story that can connect with families and parents and kids and everyone alike. Brings everybody together and something that they'll remember and something that's going to expand your imagination for really what's possible to see in live entertainment.
Now, you're a dino-teer, as they call it in this show. What's a dino-teer?
Yes, I'm the dino swing, actually. So one of the dino-teers who rotates into all the different dinosaurs. As when you come see the show, you'll see we have life-size dinosaurs. And for many of them, we have dino-teers like me who get into the dinosaur and are responsible for turning this dinosaur from a non-living creature into a living creature in front of your eyes.
Mm. Wow. So this really sounds like, for anyone who's fascinated by dinosaurs or loved the Jurassic Park movies, this is really a unique opportunity. What's the audience reaction like when they come and see the show for the first time?
Oh, yeah, it is a unique opportunity. I've been involved with many different productions over my life, and I've never been involved with one quite like this. And one of the things I love so much about it is when I see families come see the show, I love seeing this event that brings parents and children together, and the children are just enraptured with how exciting it is to see dinosaurs living and breathing in front of them, behaving like they imagine dinosaurs would, and then to see the parents record their kids with how excited their kids are. It's a very satisfying image for me as a performer and for all of us as the cast.
Well, it sounds great. Charles Clark, he's with Jurassic World Live Tour. Thanks so much, Charles.
Yes, thank you. And if people want to get tickets, they can go to JurassicWorldLiveTour.com.
JurassicWorldLiveTour.com, with shows Friday through Sunday at ViStar Veterans Arena. And here's a little more good news for your Wednesday. Finally, this hour, Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience are coming to the Florida Theater tomorrow night, Thursday. The Grammy Award-winning musician gave us a preview of what to expect.
Zydeco music is the music of the French-speaking Creoles of South Louisiana.
And it's been around since, you know, since the Creole's been around in Louisiana for over 300 years. Now, the earliest form of zydeco music was a style called, we call it the juré. And that was a style done just by using clapping your hands, stomping your feet, and your voice. And there's actually some recordings that was made by John and Alan Lomax in the 20s and 30s of this particular style of zydeco music. Instruments like the accordions, violins, the rubbo, the guitars, bass, and stuff all came later. We've played all over the world. The reaction from people who never heard it before, wow, you know, this sounds like something. This sounds like something. I get this, you know, like they feeling it, you know. And I think the reason for that is because it draws from influences from different cultures around the world. I always like to explain to people when they ask me, well, what is a Louisiana Creole? You know, my family, the Simiens, have been in Louisiana since 1756, okay? And my DNA is French, African, Spanish, Native American, German, Irish, and Italian. So it's a world influence culture, okay? Because the most of the Creoles that's been here as long as my family have that same mix. And, you know, as families, all that came into the recipe, into the food, into the music, you know. It's like there's a little something for everybody in there, you know, to relate to connect with. And it's a music that was meant to make people happy, make people dance, make people forget about their problems and just enjoy themselves.
So enjoy yourselves, folks, because guess what? We've got one pair of tickets to give away to see Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience Thursday night at the Florida Theater. Email us now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and put Zydeco in the subject line, and we will select one winner at random. That's something good for your Wednesday. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our team here at WJCT. I'm Melissa Ross. Enjoy the Zydeco music, everyone, and make it a great day.
Et vous, c'est mon soulier, va voir qui relie les. C'est temps pour m'en aller, va voir qui relie les. C'est temps pour me danser. Va voir qui relie les. Va voir qui relie les. C'est temps pour m'en danser. Oh! C'est temps pour m'en danser.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.